Welcome to Storytelling for Impact, the podcast about people who tell stories that change the world. I'm Susanna Birkwood, an international journalist and NGO communications professional with over a decade's experience working for some of the world's best-known media and nonprofit organisations. In our second episode, we'll be hearing from Jason Houston, whose photography and filmmaking aims to drive social and environmental change. A senior fellow of the International League of Conservation Photographers, Jason has worked in over 30 countries for media outlets like the New York Times, NGOs including WWF. I first heard Jason speak when I listened in to the Photo Ethics podcast, which, by the way, is another podcast you should definitely check out if you're into the ethics of storytelling. And I knew he'd be a great interviewee for this show because he made it clear that he has a huge social conscience and thinks really deeply about using pictures to change the world, not just to record it. One thing I love about Jason is that he always embeds himself in the community he's photographing, even if it means using his own time and money to do so. He's a big advocate for participatory photography as a way of establishing a more equal relationship with communities, and I was really eager to hear more about that. He did not disappoint. Now, Jason, you describe yourself as a concerned photographer, and this has been defined as someone who intentionally uses photography to inspire awareness, engagement, and change in the world. And I want to talk about all of that with you. But first of all, I'm really keen just to hear, what is the biggest adventure that you've had during your storytelling career, which I know has taken you across the world to some amazing countries?
Yeah, I've traveled to, I think, over 30 countries around the world. And almost all of my work is in remote areas of developing countries. And so the adventures have been many and include, you know, some crazy boat rides and strange bus rides and scary airplane rides and things like that. But, you know, I think the most adventurous project I've ever been on is my current work in the Amazon. And we're working in one of the most remote, largest roadless areas left in the Amazon in southeastern Peru. And even just getting there takes several days. And then once we're there to where we take off on the river and get in a boat, it can be a week or more before we're actually to the locations that we're working in. And so there's been tons of wild adventures with with that project. Everything from little four-seater Cessna planes trying to fly around and through storms and, you know, bouncing around like a roller coaster to some late night boat rides on flooded rivers that were pretty terrifying. Those physical adventures are part of it, you know, but I think, you know, there's also sort of the psychological adventure of being in such a wild and foreign place and trying to figure out how to authentically tell a story, how to connect with the people that are sometimes so different and find those commonalities that make us all feel a little more the same.
I was reading that one of the experiences you've had is with the Batwa pygmies in Uganda, a community that I was privileged enough to meet myself a couple of years back. People that were left homeless by some of the conservation efforts in the region they were living. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that was really tragic. So I guess when Uganda gazetted the national parks for the gorillas and things like that, the Batwa, who originally weren't forest people, but were driven into the forest by, you know, sort of some previous pressure on their communities, were then kicked out of the forest and left landless. It was really, really sad. It was one of the more impactful and disturbing sort of experiences I've had with marginalized communities. They were, you know, working around the margins of these parks, trying to tap into the tourism a little bit. It wasn't really like their thing or their culture. And, you know, and they take you on these little tours through the forest and try to show you how they traditionally lived when they lived there, and then at the end of it, you're sort of dropped into a, you know, exit through the gift shop kind of experience where you are just bombarded with them trying to sell little trinkets and things like that. And, you know, you see that situation and you can't blame it. You know, they're doing their best to try to struggle to survive in a really, really tough situation. And yet you feel like you're almost promoting it by supporting them, you know? And I was there actually photographing for USAID, and we were looking at how all of these enterprise efforts, including the tours that they were providing, interacted with USAID's investments in enterprise with a mind to conservation and biodiversity maintenance and stuff. So, you know, but, you know, if I was there as a tourist, it would be a really challenging struggle to think about whether or not I support it and help them out on a, you know, in sort of that immediate situation versus perpetuating this really depressing kind of scenario. It was tough. It was really tough to see. I cried that night for sure.
Mm. Yeah. I remember having some real reservations myself around the kind of tourism model when I met community members who were living on the outskirts of the jungle. I visited the very next day to come and see some gorillas in the wild, as so many people do, but people that had essentially lost their ancestral home and who were living in poverty, no longer kind of at one with the land as they'd always been. Yeah, it was really difficult emotionally, as you say. I was also fascinated to learn that you've done a lot of work with indigenous people on the other side of the world, people living in the Amazon rainforest. Can you take us back to a time when you were working with those people, and what was it like?
That project actually started in 2015 and is still ongoing. I was brought down with a team from Science Magazine to the Alto Purus region in the western upper Amazon. And the issue there was, so that area has some of the highest concentration of isolated tribal communities in the world. So people who are completely isolated from outside culture, and the, you know, pressure on the environment in that area, from everything from mining to logging to the, you know, these new narco invasions that are happening in the region as they're kicked out of Colombia and the foothills in the Andes in Peru, were increasing pressure and unplanned contact events with the isolated tribal people there. And so one of the organizations, Upper Amazon Conservancy, that helped support that Science Magazine trip, provide the logistics and the connections and a lot of the background information, was run by Chris Fagan, and he and I hit it off really well. And since then, I've been down about a dozen times in different capacities, most of the time with Upper Amazon and a few times with some other organizations, just looking at all of the issues around there. So it's really, really complicated. There are the truly isolated tribes, of which there are multiple different language groups and many different tribal groups. But then there are also people in initial contact. So previously and recently isolated communities that are starting to connect with the outside world. And they're usually connecting first through the local settled indigenous communities. So you have, you know, these indigenous communities that are super remote and settled, but also then, you know, connected to the outside world. And then you have these remote outposts, like these jungle towns where a lot of the resources are going in and out and people are traveling in and out and that sort of thing. So you have all of these different layers of different ways that people are connected to the world and trying to survive and make it against all the pressures, all the environmental pressures that are, you know, impacting the Amazon. So it's been an amazing project, and one that I feel really strongly about. And again, one that is still ongoing.
Jason, I'm really curious to hear about some of the impact that you've been able to have through your work, because, you know, the concerned photographer, your very reason for doing what you do is to inspire this awareness and inspire changes in the world. What kind of changes have you been able to affect through your photography?
You know, it's tricky. There's the whole genre of concerned photography actually started with photojournalism, you know, and of course, photojournalism in its most idealistic form is to be objective and informative, but not necessarily to advocate. The reality is that the people doing the work are always taking sides and have a perspective and are most oftentimes doing it because they want to see, you know, positive change in the world. And so, you know, in that, in originally, you kind of hope that you're just informing people and making a more intelligent conversation that can actually change the way things are thought about in the world. With the implosion of the editorial world and, you know, rise of online media and social media and increased opportunities for distribution from the, you know, the organizations, the advocacy organizations themselves, you know, a lot of what we've transition to as photojournalists is to working directly with the organizations that are working in those on those issues that we used to report on as photojournalists. And so, you know, the role that we have and the impact that we hope to have kind of changes and becomes actually, I think, a little bit more complex. You know, you're dealing with trying to be truthful and honest about the issue, because that ultimately serves the conversation, but you also have the messaging and the agenda of the organization to be responsible for, because that's who's paying you. And you know, and if you're selective about who you work for, you believe that they're doing good. And so, you know, there shouldn't be a conflict of interest there, but there are times where, you know, you have to really sort of check what you're doing and make sure that you're holding true to your principles and in your own personal moral compass so that you're, I don't know, producing work that can last beyond that particular commission or campaign.
I'd love to explore that a bit more with you, Jason. I get the sense that, you know, there have been occasions perhaps when you felt there is a conflict with your own values. And I wondered if maybe you could talk a bit about that.
For sure. Sometimes when you end up in a location, you know, the program, especially the type of work I do where it's in really, really remote areas abroad, and I'm American, so it's usually for American-based organizations, the awareness of what's actually happening on the ground can be limited. And so, you know, every now and then I've shown up in a place and the programs are, you know, working a little bit differently in the community than the program managers back home think they are. And, you know, in almost all cases, it's a learning opportunity for the organization, and they really truly are trying to, you know, honestly make good impact. And so there's a, you know, we usually are able to just sort of pivot it to a learning and make adjustments on the fly, but trying to be sensitive to that and aware of what's really going on is actually become kind of an important part of being there as a representative and a, you know, on the ground observer for them.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And definitely something I've witnessed myself kind of working inside NGOs, when you get to a location and the project isn't perhaps what you thought it was going to be, and that makes your job communicating that project super difficult. In your experience, when that has happened, does the NGO decide to tell the story, warts and all, in an authentic way, or has it more typically been a case, well, we'll find another project that kind of ticks the box and communicates the message that we want to get out there?
In my experience, it's kind of happened all across that spectrum. I had one project in Ecuador that just was not at all what everyone thought it was once we got on the ground. And that one ended up becoming an internal case study, you know. And so after being down there and sort of pivoting to explore what was different and why things weren't working the way they expected, and that becoming the story rather than, you know, talking about the community and their challenges or successes or whatever, we went back and actually presented at the organization for one of their annual retreats. So I thought they handled that really well. you know, a lot of times it's just a pivot, you know, it's just a pivot. But, you know, the NGOs have sort of dual requirements in their messaging. They need to show success. You know, they want to show people that what they're doing is working. But at the same time, if everything is successful and it's all done, then they don't have any need for funding. And so if there truly is need, then you also need to show need, which means that you show the shortcomings or where they're not being effective yet. And so it's always a little bit of a tricky balance, but, you know, I tend to try to be careful with who I work for and have the opportunity to work for organizations that see the, you know, see those dynamics in the same way I do. So I don't really experience too much conflict with that.
I mean, you talked a bit about the kind of, I felt the sense of helplessness that you experienced when you met with the Batwa Pygmies and you witnessed what their situation was. I'd be interested to explore how you cope with any times that you've encountered issues, or problems, suffering among the people that you're reporting on, you're covering for an NGO perhaps, which you felt helpless to address through your work.
I mean, so much of my work is in really poor communities, and so I see a lot of struggles. Mm-hmm. It's also an oversimplification to say that just because people are poor, they lack the resources that they're suffering. There's a lot of beauty in there as well, and I think, you know, helping people transcend those oversimplistic views of those communities can help see that things aren't hopeless, they just need help, or we just need to change the system so that they can thrive on their own, you know, give them the tools to thrive on their own. It's tough. I look at what we do as communicators, as photojournalists or photographers or advocates, and we go really deep and we spend a lot of time there. I rarely do an assignment that's less than 2 or 3 weeks. And oftentimes I'll add a little bit of my own time in there to really get to know a community, just because it makes the work feel a lot better. And a lot of these places I travel, I can afford to do that because it's so affordable once you're there to add on a week. And we go deep, but when you come back and you distill down the story and you present it out, it becomes a flash in someone's experience. You know, it's a moment in their day, and they run through that story and they feel bad, and then they go shopping on Amazon or whatever. And, you know, that's where it gets tough, is when you feel like you really connect with a place, and then you know, the next challenge is helping other people connect with the place, and they're even one more degree removed from it. Mm. So not sure I have an answer. Sometimes you know, you just do it on faith, you know.
Would you say that you're good at kind of staying in your lane and recognizing what part you have to play in helping these people or not helping these people, i.e. your role is to tell the story and there are other things that are going to fix their lives and make things better for them, but that's your part?
No, I'm probably not very good at staying in my lane. I get pretty involved. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, part of what I really want to do is expand the perspective that the partners I work with have on the community. I feel it's almost a responsibility to expand it, to make sure that what the communities are really experiencing and what the communities really need and what they really want is part of what I bring back. And again, you know, I try to pick partners who appreciate that, as opposed to, you know, an organization that might have a really hard line, you know, specific mission, and they don't want to veer from that at all. We're doing it partly because we want to, you know, protect the planet, or for sort of global ethical considerations, or whatever the, you know, agenda is for the assignment. But at the same time, it's the local communities that live really close to those resources and rely intimately on those resources that are the ones who are the first affected by how those resources are managed. And so, you know, I feel it's a moral obligation to honor them, actually.
Mm. I think that staying in your lane is easier when you do actually have the ability to tell a powerful story, which you feel can actually have some real world impact. And don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for staying in your lane. I think that's you know, not necessarily the most human approach. You know, if you see suffering, it's absolutely natural to want to help and to do everything that you can, right? But what I'm leading to is, I'm wondering if there are times when you haven't even been able to tell the story, you haven't even been able to do your part, perhaps because you've had a lack of access to what the real story was, or the NGO you were working with perhaps decided not to use your content or to tell a different story than the one you wanted or felt that needed to be told.
Yeah, well, access is probably the biggest challenge always. So even when you have good access, you know, we really don't have that good of access as, you know, international photojournalists parachuting in, even if you put in some extra time and get a generous assignment, and you're still just barely scratching the surface on what these, you know, what people's lives are like in these far off places. So I think that's, you know, that's potentially the biggest challenge. But yeah, you're right. There's always that sort of ethical consideration of the greater good for the planet versus the, you know, the importance of taking care of the individuals at the time. And I guess my personal perspective is I would always err on, you know, honoring the individuals that I'm interacting with first, and hoping that through that it's consistent with advocating for, you know, these global considerations.
If we think about NGO storytelling as a whole, what is the biggest problem, would you say, with the way it's traditionally been done?
I think the biggest challenge is that this is a challenge for all media, is that our attention spans are just so short and complexity gets lost. And yet complexity is where, you know, these stories really get figured out, and what needs to be done, and, you know, what we need to understand in order to figure out what the next steps are, you know, is tricky. And so I think the biggest challenge I have is just that the complexity gets lost. You know, I remember 10 or 15 years ago when I really started working with NGOs a lot, one of the big considerations was, you know, this balance between saving the trees and tigers and coral reefs with the impact and the dynamics of the communities that live in those places. You know, fisheries is a great example. So much of the world's overfishing happens in the nearshore environment, you know, and yet that's also food security for, you know, a huge proportion of the global population. And so, you know, what takes priority? Is it the coral reefs and the fish populations, or is it food security for a massive number of, you know, people who are living on the edge? Mm. And those kind of complexities are difficult. And a lot of people come to an organization because they care about one thing or another, and they don't want to hear these sort of competing agendas. And it's unfortunate that those agendas have to compete, but that is kind of the reality when it comes down to, you know, communicating to a general population and to the supporters and stuff of specific organizations.
Mm. Jason, have you ever witnessed people being exploited by organizations telling their stories?
I guess so, yeah. And I think you also see it happening the other way. You see the communities learning how to play the local organizations as well. So you see, you know, and that's one thing we have to kind of vet when we're in these communities is, you know, I know that in some of the places in the Amazon, they refer to a visit as bringing projects, you know, so they know you're bringing projects, and they learn how to message, and they learn how to say the right things to get some support while they can, while you're there, while the organization is there. And then the organization, you know, leaves, and they just move on to go back to their normal lives until the next organization shows up, and then they get what they can out of that one. And so I've seen it happen both ways. People are people. I think a lot of times, well, I think working with the NGOs, especially when we're working in exotic places and far away with faraway communities, we have to be really careful not to be exploiting them, not to be, you know, either sort of the poverty porn concept of just, you know, suffering and sympathy, you know, but also just sort of tokenizing the, you know, the natives or oversimplifying their lives again, you know, and saying things like, you know, generalizing about the, or over romanticizing the subsistence lifestyles when what the community really wants is to, you know, develop like the rest of the world and, you know, move into a consumer economy or something, you know? So again, it's that complexity that gets lost that, that makes it kind of challenging, and where it challenges you to just be honest and really, you know, stop and listen to the community as opposed to come in with some preconceived notions of, you know, what the projects, you know, should be accomplishing. Mm.
And I think that for you, that's where participatory photography has been quite a game changer. Is that fair?
For sure. Yeah, that is, you know, that's a large reason that I brought it in was, you know, my own sort of personal challenges with being in a community and realizing that even when you come in and ask questions, the answers to those questions are kind of predetermined by the questions that you ask. And so trying to figure out different ways of opening it up, and you know, participatory photography has been around for a long time. I think, you know, really officially came to life in the early 80s. But, you know, the way I think about it is to address a lot of these things that we've been talking about. I think, you know, for one thing, it's to empower the community and to involve them on a level more as equals. And that's sort of the traditional, you know, role of participatory photography. I think it also addresses some needs that the organizations have to better engage the community and have the community be a more complete part of the conversation about what's going on there and how those resources, those shared resources, will be managed. It also can become a learning opportunity for the organizations. You know, again, a lot of the organizations I work with, when they work in those remote communities, there's a whole process of going in and surveying the community and finding out, you know, what their values are and what their needs and desires are, what some of the challenges are and those sorts of things. Again, that process is, you know, structured by and predetermined by the NGO's agenda. And if you can sort of flip that around and make it a lot more open-ended and let people explore their own lives in new ways, and then, you know, share what they discover about themselves through the participatory process, then it's, you know, you definitely come across a lot more subtlety within a community, a lot more of that complexity comes to the surface, and then you sort of have to address it too, because now you've started a conversation in the community where they're talking among themselves and they're openly discussing it with us who are visiting, and it's pretty powerful. I actually really, it's becoming a more and more a part of my work. And you know, even if we're not doing an official participatory process, having meetings where they participate in the creation of my work, you know, so looking at work in progress and having conversations about how I'm representing and what we're looking at and, you know, what I might have missed or whether or not I got it right is also becoming an increasingly large part of my work and approach.
Right. Because in some of the places you work, you've been doing listening sessions, right? What exactly are they?
It was just a term I tried to, you know, came up with to try to explain a little bit of what it was, but it actually started with a project I was doing with USAID, and so USAID has had for 20 years has had this, or 25 years now, has had this process, this approach of investing in enterprise as a way of addressing biodiversity conservation. So for example, if you've got poachers poaching, you know, wildlife, you teach them to become beekeepers, and the idea is that they will poach less because now they have an alternative source of income. And that's mm-hmm. a lot of assumptions are built into that. And that's actually, you know, a naive example, because oftentimes they will beekeep and continuing to poach and make even, you know, more money or whatever. There's a lot of complexities. And so the project was to do a 20-year retrospective, looking back on six different locations around the world where they had implemented this process and see what the impacts were and ground truth some of these assumptions and things like that. And so And that was one of the times I really realized that we go in with a lot of assumptions, and what we really need is to have as open a conversation with the community about how this has gone as possible. And so in one of the locations in the Philippines, I had a really nice relationship with the local community. And I was just like, you know what, we should just have an open community meeting where anyone who wants to show up is invited, and we'll show images. You know, I've got an edit of what I've been doing here, and we'll show it, and we'll just see how people respond and hear from them what they think about how we're representing this, because ultimately it's their story, you know. And it was great. You know, you'd go through the images, and sometimes they'd laugh, and sometimes they'd go silent, and sometimes they'd start talking about it, and then they'd say, oh yeah, and so-and-so is also doing this, and that's related. And it was super eye-opening. And so I've tried to incorporate that as much as possible, even if it's in a really casual way, with just, you know, making sure that Lightroom is syncing to my phone so that if I'm in a conversation with someone, I can pull it out and show them some things and get their feedback right away. You know, and it's tricky because it's not to vet it. It's not to allow them to manipulate the story. You know, there still has to be some journalistic integrity in the nonfiction side of the work, but it can be super informative, and it's turned out to be a really helpful process in making sure that I understand the story I'm trying to tell.
Mm. And you've lived with some communities, I believe. You've actually been embedded. I mean, you spoke about typically staying for a week or two or three, but have you been with communities for longer than that? And how long does it really take to get to know them in a way that you have a chance of portraying them authentically in your work?
Assignments are hard. You know, the budgets are hard to come by, and especially within NGOs, the communications budgets can be smaller than most of the, you know, project budgets or anything. And so it's tricky. I had one project recently with RARE, an organization based out of Arlington, Virginia, but that works around the world and throughout the developing tropics, at a project in the Philippines for them. And that was looking at a fishing community prior to their projects actually being there. So it was really to get a profile of the fishing community and understand how they live and, you know, what the challenges were and what the people's perspective on various things were, and even just the values in a community. And they originally had wanted to set me up in a guest house on this little island. And within a couple of days of being there, I was just like, I'm way too isolated from this community. And, you know, I'm a visitor. And one of the fishermen who I had met was this great guy, Rodell. And I asked him if I could, through a translator, because I didn't speak the language, but I asked him if I could just move out of the guest house and live with him. And so I ended up living with him for 3 weeks, sleeping awesome. On his floor and just completely matching his schedule. So every morning at 4, we'd get up, he'd make some coffee and we'd eat a little breakfast, and then we'd head out and go fishing for the day. And then I'd come back in the afternoon and we'd just go through his day-to-day routine. And it was interesting because I didn't speak the language, I actually got to have a more intimate relationship with him. You know, he kind of just had to accept that I would just shadow him everywhere, and we couldn't really discuss whether or not, you know, he was tired of me being there or not. And it was awesome. You know, I got to experience every aspect of his life rather than just the times he was going out and fishing or the times that we coordinated to meet up and do this thing. And by the end of it, I felt like part of his family. You know, I was interacting with him and his friends, and we were having, you know, parties at night, and went to a birthday party, and was there when he was putting his kids down and making dinner. And, you know, that's an ideal kind of scenario, if I can really actually just live with people and not, you know, have to decide based on fractured knowledge and, you know, when I'm going to show up and make photographs and when I'm not going to be there.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I've never heard of that. Although I have to admit that, so I've done a lot of content gathering across Africa and Latin America. And when I first began doing it, I naively thought that I would be put up in a homestay with a local family when I was doing these trips. Kind of little did I know that it's all too common for NGOs to use large multinational hotel chains to put up staff, often for security reasons, to be fair. But both for ethical reasons and for, like you've been saying, getting your chance to really get immersed in the community and really effectively convey as best as you can as an outsider their way of living through your storytelling. I think that my idea of the homestays would have been a brilliant alternative to what the reality is, or at least, you know, more community-based endeavors like social enterprises, which are really B&Bs embedded in the community.
For sure. And, you know, and anthropologists do this, right? I mean, you know, part of what I've tried to learn from when I'm thinking about, you know, my goal of really understanding what I'm doing before I'm turning around and telling the story to other people, you know, I've looked to anthropology a lot for how this works. And anthropologists will do this. They'll go and they'll live there and they'll try to learn the language, or, you know, really observe the every aspect of the daily cycle. There's even a concept called visual anthropology, where note-taking is done with a camera as opposed to writing things down, because then you're not limited by language. You're not limited by that translation and interpretation of what you recognize that you saw. Mm-hmm. And you're actually capturing, you know, using the objective part of photography to capture what's in front of you. And then you can interpret that in different ways over time as you learn more. And, you know, so I try to think about all of those things when I'm approaching those. Yeah.
Yeah. I was fascinated to hear that participatory photography has been a thing since the 1980s, actually, because it's definitely a buzzword in the NGO sector. And, you know, it has been for a couple of years now. And the whole concept of user-generated content, I think a lot of NGOs are putting their focus there, and there's pressure for them to do so in a way that I can't see that there really was previously. How do you quality control the storytelling, the photos, the communications, when you're putting the camera in other people's hands?
You have to change the expectations. You know, you're not, so yeah, going back to the history of participatory photography, Photo Voice really brought it to the forefront. I believe that was in the early 80s. They have a good manual about doing this. There was a...
And what is related... Photo Voice for those that don't know it?
Yeah, Photo Voice is an organization that focused on doing participatory photography projects to empower the local community. And there's a great documentary called Born into Brothels that sort of details out that their process. And then they, you know, Photo Voice, probably photovoice.org. You can Google their website, but or we can add it later. But they also produce a manual for doing these projects, and they produce resources like, you know, the releases and the other legal considerations you have to have for it. So it's a really good resource. So Photo Voice was teaching people to become photographers. You know, that was kind of the goal. I don't look at it as teaching people to actually become photographers. I look at it as sort of recognizing the ubiquity of photography in our society these days, and the fact that at some level, many, many, many more people are photographers nowadays than ever before in history. And that's with the phones and with social media and those sorts of things. And so, you know, even if the photography is not good photography, it can still communicate a ton, and it can still become a very important tool in people communicating their experiences. And so, you know, if someone is interested in learning the technical side of photography, then I try to teach them that. And of course, you know, and that can have another side effect of leaving some capacity in the community. But the cameras I provide are really simple cameras. I set them up so that they can basically be point and shoot, you know, work just like they're used to doing with their phones. And in some cases, we've even used social media too as a way of interacting with the local community. So, you know, so that it's consistent. It's kind of meeting people where they're at from a technical perspective and recognizing that there can still be a ton of very valuable communication happening through photography.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's something that can complement kind of very professional NGO communications, but it doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be, you know, a replacement.
Not necessarily, you know, but and a lot of the projects are, you know, I'll work alongside them. So I did a project in Mozambique with a fishing community, and we did I was photographing along while the individuals participating were also making photographs, and that was a nice process because I was able to sort of riff with them and learn from what they were producing, and then I could go back and explore some of those themes myself as well. And the fact that they were cruising around the community with cameras sort of opened up the rest of the community to me. And the rest of the community understood a little better of why I was there with the camera and doing my thing. And in some cases, you know, we've actually, you know, shifted the focus of these assignments to be about the participatory photography rather than my work. And then, you know, when that work is used to communicate later to the NGO's audience, I think you have an opportunity to explain it and say, this is a different way of looking at it. And then that changes the expectation of the viewers that they're not looking for beautiful photographs, but they're looking for meaningful photographs. And flip side of that is I've seen some really amazing raw work come out of this. There was one fisherman in Mozambique, and he just had this, he had this totally intuitive way of photographing that broke a lot of photography rules. But really worked to express what he was trying to say. And that's brilliant. You know, like we're always looking for artists who are doing that at a professional level. And this guy was, you know, never very little experience using a camera and just did it naturally and intuitively. It was kind of amazing. And, you know, sometimes you see that stuff too, and it's brilliant.
That is really cool. And your latest project, I believe, is with WWF. You've just finished. You were doing some work on a couple of Native American reservations.
Yeah, with the pandemic, we were I was in conversations with the media folks at WWF US, you know, through the magazine and some of the assignment work I've done with the magazine there about how we could capture some of their work on the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations in South Dakota. There was a reintroduction of bison for food security and for sort of reference of the cultural traditions in the communities there. And we decided to approach that using participatory photography. So because of the pandemic and because of travel restrictions and especially the impact that COVID has had on the Native reservations, we did it all remote. So we had, we found some local facilitators within the community who could help just on the ground with things like physically distributing cameras or helping participants get things uploaded if needed. And then we used, you know, Zoom and phone calls and online tools to try to implement it. And it was a real challenge. You know, there's technical limitations in some of those communities, and then just working remote doesn't have the same kind of intimacy that you have when you're there with people. But it was also really amazing. You know, it was, I think people felt very empowered. Like, you know, when I show up in a community and I've got my camera gear and I'm teaching people photography or helping people with photography, that I think there's a little bit of an intimidation factor sometimes that you have to work around. And with this not being there, there was a lot less of that. So I think the participants actually in some ways felt empowered to do the work. And we got some great stuff out of it. You know, it was cool.
Awesome. And so for others then, whether they be NGOs or people like yourself, photographers, journalists who are wanting to get started in participatory photography, what would your three top tips be?
You know, I think there's some really basic process stuff, and things like the Photo Voice resources are a great place to start, just so you understand the history of it and the, you know, some of the way that these processes are put together with some of the legal considerations around the usage of the photography and that sort of thing. There are a lot of ethical considerations when you're entering a community this way. It's one thing to go into a community with your own camera and approach people and insert yourselves into their lives. It's a whole nother thing to give cameras to their friends and then ask their friends to go and insert themselves into their community's lives. Really careful planning with the NGO about you know, what the goals are, and really thinking through how those, you know, how this project is going to play out, you know, how it's going to be used and what impact you hope it has, because it's very dynamic. And again, people are a lot more used to making photographs now with their phones and things like that than they ever have been in history. And they're a lot more used to sharing photographs with Instagram and Facebook and social media in general. And, you know, so it's a very dynamic space that is, you know, importantly understand that. And I'm always happy to talk about it. So you can reach out to me if anyone has questions.
Fantastic. Jason, thank you so much for coming on Storytelling for Impact. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm always honored at the opportunity to share. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Now, one of my aims with Storytelling for Impact is to spark conversations about how we can tell stories that affect change and how we can get better at doing it. So if you enjoyed today's episode, then please think about sharing it on social media or telling a friend about it. In next month's show, we'll be speaking to Rachel Erskine, Communications Manager at the medical care charity AmRep Health Africa, about how she coped with the trauma of interviewing survivors of the Nepal earthquake in 2015.